Welcome everyone. And this is the first Sunday in September, and the summer is nearly over, if it ever began. So the subject for this is authenticity versus inauthenticity, appearances versus reality. Yeah. So authenticity, I don't quite know what I'm supposed to say about that. But appearance and reality, this is a very interesting subject because, with the meditation, as you become aware of nature of the human mind, of your own world that you live in and the perceptions that you regard as real, the more you see through them and the things aren't what they seem or the world isn't what you think, and you are not what you believe you are. And so this is, sometimes meditation is rather frightening to people because it is a kind of stripping down of the whole conditioned process that one spent a lifetime acquiring. So people, meditators, go through periods of great fear as they that security, that seeming security of knowing where I belong, who I am, what's right, what's wrong, as it begins to fall apart, it can seem like you're losing control or you're having a breakdown or all that at once seemed real and true and stable and constant is suddenly no longer, doesn't have that quality of stability. And so stability is, we like that sense of certainty and stability. And so you notice many people will settle for very kind of inferior identities just because it gives them a stability to know that you're the most stupid person in the class or you're a failure and things like this. Because even though these are negative, at least if you decide that you're a failure in life, you have a kind of you don't have to try anymore to be successful. And in a society which is very competitive and puts so much importance on succeeding, then oftentimes failure is a kind of a relief. I can't do it, I don't have what it takes, I'll settle for that. I remember years ago, and I was in undergraduate in the University of Washington in Seattle. I'd work weekends at the charity hospital in Seattle. And it was interesting, they put me in the emergency room, so I would receive all these people that were in accidents or fights or whatever, the tramps they'd pick up who were drunk or passed out in on the street or homeless people they'd bring into the charity hospital as a kind of emergency situation. So my duty was to especially clean up the tramps or the homeless men that would be brought in on the weekend, which was rather daunting at first, because this was the very type of person I most dreaded having any contact with. I was always brought up to clean my fingernails. So So when they described it to me, I felt kind of almost the desire to say, well, I think I'll leave. But anyway, I pursued this, and it was quite interesting. I never forget it, because and once you get over the kind of aversion or repulsion, that maybe these kind of people bring up, because they're dirty, they smell bad, and sometimes, in states of delusion. But getting to know them, as you get to, as you bathe them and wash their clothes and do things for them, you get to see a different side. And so many of them were surprisingly quite intelligent, gifted people who had settled for failure. And in a way, I could understand, because, of course, in American university, it was very competitive, and you're kind of burning yourself out trying to, to get the grades to compete in the system, and then you're kind of primed for that. But the price you pay is that you have to, you feel a stress, incredible stress, and at the same time desire to run away from it, to get out of the system. So I found out I could operate within the system well enough, but I didn't like the system anymore. So, and this was the great opportunity, becoming a Buddhist monk, getting outside the system, where I didn't have to become a tramp. Instead, I became a beggar. And this was put to a test, because in 1972, I think, I went to India for the first time, and I decided I'd travel in India as a traditional mendicant, a Buddhist monk, just like you read about in the scriptures. So that was like 2,500 years before. I just was curious to see if you could survive, say, on alms food and living in the way that you read about in the Pali scriptures of Theravada Buddhism. So somebody gave another monk and myself a return flight tickets from Bangkok to Calcutta. And then Calcutta, suddenly you arrive at the airport there, and this was 1970. This was 1972, and it was just during this Bangladesh war, where it was separating from Pakistan. So Calcutta was crowded with homeless people everywhere, and the streets were paved with human beings sleeping out on the streets. And I'd lived in Asia for several years before that, but I'd never seen anything quite on that scale. And then suddenly seeing myself as another one of these, homeless wanderers. By choice, though. Mine was choosing to do so. Theirs was more or less by default. They couldn't help themselves. So then the thought of, we went to Bodh Gaya, the birthplace or the place of enlightenment of the Buddha, after a week or so in Calcutta, and then there I went on Bindabad, or the alms round, and we managed to survive a week or so quite pleasantly in a Buddhist holy place like Bodh Gaya. And then we started walking from Bodh Gaya. We were going to visit the holy places and walk by walking to them. So we were walking to the main railway junction town of Gaya, and we did our alms round, went on our alms round in Gaya. And so I was walking along in the streets and I've been used to Thailand, where everything is done in an incredibly polite way. And, you always feel that in Thailand you're doing them a favor. So they'll say, you know, please stop, and we want to offer and come running after you. But in India, it wasn't quite that easy. And it had to be much more aggressive. And so I wasn't quite used to it. It was kind of against the whole ethos of my own training as a bhikkhu. And then we didn't get any food that day. And then a man started yelling at me from a tea shop saying, "What are you doing here begging in our country?" And started abusing me in English. And so then I thought, you know, what am I doing here? And started doubting my own position there. And then, of course, I, you know, started considering, but this is what, you know, in the scriptures, the Pali scriptures, this is, you know, according to the story of the legend of the Buddha, the Gautama, the founder of what we know as Buddhism, this is what he recommended. So his father was a king, and when he went on alms round in the kingdom, without telling his father he was there, and his father was furious. He says, "You know, don't humiliate me. You could just come to the palace, and I'll give you a meal. You want to go around begging?" You know, you're a prince. And the Buddha said, "No, I'm not." Well, these are the kind of stories that sustain, you know, they're part of a tradition and cultural tradition. And of course, in my own instance, you're operating in a different, you know, you're operating in a different culture than one than your own culture. Your values are still influencing how you see things, like success and failure, or appearance and reality. And of course, the very act of walking with an alms bowl without any money and obviously needing food, then this was, you know, in my own cultural background, a sign of failure. It's what we most dread, isn't it? The idea for a man of my generation, American, to be a beggar in India is is probably the worst possible scenario you could think of. But actually, the reality of it wasn't that way, because of the attitude, the way of looking at it, and actually, I lived in India for nearly 6 months, just living in that way, on alms food. And of course, you know, it was, you know, as I became more confident and more used to the situation, it was like an adventure. It was really, you know, I wouldn't have missed it for anything, because it was an adventure. I couldn't do it now, I'm too old. But then I was considerably younger. And then we think of, what is reality? Is the reality our own view of life, or our culturals, what our culture defines as reality? And so here, of course, we're told to live in the real world. And oftentimes we're accused of not living in the real world. Here at Amravati, it's not the real world. The real world is in London. And and we're living in some kind of unreal world, I suppose. But then these are the words that one needs to not just assume you understand, but therefore reflection to explore them. Explore the terms we use. What is reality? What is real? And then, of course, we have, you know, various views and opinions according to cultural values, cultural views of what's real, what's true, and what's false. For example, now we're told about the war in Iraq and the problems in Israel and Palestinians. And what is the reality in those countries? You know, what is real? We're told one thing by the government here, and what we hear from others, and what we hear from the United States, how they see the reality of the situation. And then if I suppose if one you know, it'd be a very different view if one went to those particular places and asked the local people who are right in the midst of it. And or the ones that are fighting, what they call the terrorists, you know, what their vision of reality is. And it's so easy to assume that our reality is there, is real. And what they think is real is illusion and appearance. And so we manage to misunderstand, not really appreciate any other perspective maybe than our own view. So in Buddhist meditation practice, the aim is to get to the essence before the conditioning process operates, the appearances and the reactions we have. Like, we're all conditioned to react to certain images, certain stimulation, things that we experience through the senses, through sight, sound, smell, taste, touch. So we have emotional reactions of feeling secure, insecure, stable or unstable. We have appearances of what's right and true and what's wrong and what's false. We, living in a community such as this one here, Amaravati, where everybody lives, we try to live by the same moral standard, moral precepts. We all agreed when we enter this community to live by the precepts from the tradition. So they're moral precepts, or they're about lifestyle, about ways of relating to property, to each other, to the world around. And these are, not all of them have any kind of moral value, but they're just various standards of agreement on how we're going to live together. So then our lives aren't an endless competitive struggle, arguing about who's going to do the dishes today, who's going to do this or take that, or whose turn is it. It's a more agreement on kind of smoothing out these areas of personal opinion and view towards an agreement to make our lives as a community run more smoothly. Then on the moral level, this is to refrain it from doing harmful, divisive things through action and speech. But then in the reality that we experience then is how we react. You know, whatever we're feeling, whatever we're experiencing in the moment is real for us at that moment. But we're looking at this reality not in terms of a cultural position or even a religious one, but in terms of characteristics that are common to conditioned phenomena. So this is the Buddhist plan, a way of teaching, was to bring everything to make it more simple, so we can get actual perspective on the way things are in this realm that we're very much committed to and involved in for a lifetime. So whether it's, you know, we like it or don't, agree or disagree, approve or disapprove, whether we consider, you know, somebody else wrong and I'm right. What we're really looking at is this very sense of a self that we create, and also the nature of thoughts, of what we see, what we hear, smell, taste, touch, our emotional habits. Our perspective on them is from this mindfulness position. So this is like last week's talk was about the center point, this ground zero, this present here and now. Because it's from here and now that we actually experience everything. You know, when you think about you're going on your holiday next week and what you hope to experience and what you long to have and, the wonderful holiday, restful and full of fun and pleasure, is merely speculation, isn't it, at this point? It's you hope and you want and you long for this, and then also the possibility of everything falling apart. You know, of strikes at Heathrow, and or maybe you'll start feeling guilty about taking an airplane because of pollution. I mean, there's always something, you know, something to possibility to. To make whatever this great promise in the future to become unpleasant, but we hope everything will be pleasant. Now this is awareness here and now, at the future. At this moment, when we're sitting here in this room, is the future is possibility. It's a potential. It could be. It's. Probabilities, it's memories. We can project into the future all kinds of possibilities that we remember from the past. But what we're establishing is this awareness in the present where we actually begin to acknowledge this is reality here and now. The real world, that which is real is now. The future is potential. It's possibility, it's maybe, could be, might be, it could be anything. It could be absolutely fantastic holiday or a terrible nightmare. But the now is where we're resting and where we find our stability is in this awareness. Not in worrying about the future, but we can recognize that how we do create worry about the future. As we awaken and recognize the state of mind that you're experiencing in the present. So this is real. This is not you're not making it up. It's not even a Buddhist position. It's not a doctrine. It's not about believing in Buddha or anything else. It's about just paying attention to the way it is. And whatever you're feeling at this moment, you know, it's if it's a total delusion, or it is a condition changing, and so your relationship to what you're thinking and feeling, your own sense of righteousness. Like it's very easy to become caught up in righteousness. I know what should be done in the future. I know how Amaravati should the vision for Amaravati, I know how it should go. And my view is right. And if you don't agree, then you're wrong, because I'm right. if I stop believing in my own sense of being right and start looking at that, one thing I can say, the reality of that is that it is a condition, isn't it? It's something I create in the present. I'm right, you're wrong. That is a condition that I'm actually creating in the present. It's a thought. It's a sense of me as a person being right. My view, my take on the future of this monastery is right. And yours, because you don't agree with me, is wrong. Now this is what we're developing, wisdom or punya, to be able to discern. It's not taking sides about right and wrong or how any Buddhist monastery should be. It's not about ideals, but it's about the way things are in terms of reality, the reality of, and that what is true, what we can actually prove and see and recognize for ourselves without grasping anyone else's viewpoint or taking a particular religious position or cultural attitude or value system. Now this is very wonderful in its way. It's very simple, but we are programmed in a very different way. And this is like from my own background, you know, when you live in a different society like Thailand, Thai Buddhism, it's a good mirror for your own cultural assumptions. Because coming from a kind of American middle class, white middle-class American. They're kind of, in many ways, the privileged people of that country. You have a natural sense of on one level, you've never felt inferior racially, because you've been brought up in a society where that side of your experience is always affirmed, and taken for granted, and assumed. It's not actually taught, actually, it's assumed. And so then when you can be very broad-minded in being against any kind of racial biases and race prejudices, but in the reality of looking at life, I've never felt that kind of inferiority, because it's, even though I have been, traveling in areas where they hate white people, I've never, it's never been part of my cultural conditioning to see myself in any way on that level as inferior. But where I can experience suffering and feeling of inferiority is on a personal level. Because in a competitive society in middle-class America, it's very much, it's so competitive to prove your value, your worth, justify your existence as a person. And where it's no longer a matter of race, it's a matter of, being able to prove that you are the winner or the top, or you're a success. And so then, and this can be termed anything in business or in university system, in relationships with others, in where you relate to the opposite sex or whatever, all this sense of inferiority or inadequacy can arise on a personal level. So recognizing this, this sense of not being good enough or not clever enough or whatever, not, this sense of when somebody insults you and you can take it quite personally, that sense of being insulted is like this, or being praised. So being a Buddhist monk is quite an interesting one. In Thailand, for example, Buddhist monks are highly regarded. So when I go to Thailand, you just take for granted people are going to respect you. So you go to Bangkok and people pay respect and they treat you very politely, and they never abuse you or say horrible things to you. But when you come back to Europe, you can you can nobody's ever attacked me physically here, but I mean certainly schoolboys and that and skinheads and kind of truck drivers can really be very abusive, and as well as kind of posh people can be very, very abusive sometimes, because of they see you as something outside, an alien, a foreigner, something to laugh at, or something, a misfit. Because their reality is what their conditioned view of themselves and their own values. There is so much anguish and suffering now, and there always has been, because basically most human beings live in the realm of delusion. And it's a wonder that it's not any worse than it is. But we do have one thing that human beings do have is ability to agree on moral standards. So we still have the same basic instincts they have animals of when somebody to seek revenge if somebody kills one of my family, then I can still feel the impulse to want to kill the person that killed my brother or whatever, or seek revenge in some way. So revenge or reaction is certainly an understandable feeling of wanting to kill somebody. But then on a moral level, you know, as a Buddhist, and as a Buddhist monk especially, you know, you can still feel that, but you don't act on it or speak on it. So in the present moment, you know, one can feel it, the desire to kill somebody, and at the same time be aware that this is not to be said or put into any kind of action or gesture. And this can all be happening simultaneously, because, say, the commitment to the restraint, the life of a Buddhist monk, traditional Buddhist monk, and its moral sense of non-violence, of not murdering, not taking the life intentionally of another human being. So this is the here and now reality of being aware that even the desire, the impulse to destroy something offensive, and at the same moment being able to be aware, have that awareness which includes both the feeling, the emotion, and the sense of restraint through the commitment to the Vinaya discipline of Buddhism. So this is where mindfulness has this expansive, embracive function in terms of experience. It's not linear, like right and wrong, good and bad are linear qualities, aren't they? It's about thought, it's perception. And of course you can only have one thought moment at a time. You can't think two thoughts at the same moment. So, I mean, your thoughts can move very quickly through consciousness, but you can't think of two different things at the same moment. But you can, through intuitive awareness, through mindfulness, be aware of both the thought, the emotion, and the traditional restraint that you've committed yourself to. So this is pointing to the value of, say, in a Buddhist sense of sila or morality, which is we call precepts, because this is a conscious choice that we choose these precepts. You know, we ask for them. We see their value. We want to test them out, and so we agree to take these precepts, or if we're not interested on that level, just obeying the laws of the land, be law-abiding citizens here in England. And that can have a strong influence on what we do, what we say, how we react in any given situation. Now, people that don't have that sense of restraint or commitment to law or to precepts or commandments or moral principles, then that doesn't come into it. When I was in the military, I used to wonder sometimes at some of the. I was on a ship for several years that where there were about 250 men on this ship, and when we, you know, it was a cargo supply ship that traveled all over the Pacific Ocean in the mid 50s. And so you go to different ports, and some of these people you were living with had no sense of moral restraint. You know, they had nothing to stop them from doing the most stupid things I've ever seen. And I was very young then, you know, I couldn't believe it, because, you know, they would get themselves in, you know, beaten up and you know, for no reason at all, you know, that I could see, except when they started drinking alcohol, you know, drinks and things like this, then they'd lose all control, you know, all restraint would go out the window, you know, any kind of physical restraint even would pack up, and they'd just be caught in just rage and reactions to very silly things, you know. So you could bait them, you could wind them up, you could get them going very easily just by knowing if you said this is the way they'd react. So you see the value of this, how the Buddha actually used moral precepts, not as kind of commandments or orders from above. They're not imperatives, moral imperatives. And I think this is very important, especially for Western people, for Europeans, because we're used to seeing morality always as a kind of imperative. You know, you obey the law or you'll be punished. You keep the moral precepts, moral commandments, or God will punish you. So it's a, and God gives these commandments, so you, they're like, that's what an imperative is. It says, you got to not kill anybody. And you shouldn't even think of it. And then a run around sexual restraint. You know, even having a lustful thought is adultery. I mean, if you're a married man and you look at an attractive woman and have a feeling of sexual desire, you've committed adultery in your mind. So you're carrying this sense of guilt and into the mental world also, that you shouldn't even have a lustful thought. And this is taken on a highly personal way, because you're going to be punished for it. Now, with awareness, because it's not based on, it's not about right and wrong and what's good and bad, it's based on the reality of now, of learning to awaken and observe and recognize just the simplicity of this, what I call intuitive awareness, of pure conscious knowing, cognizance here and now. It's like this. And this is a wide sense of wideness, I mean, embracing. It's not focused on one thing. It's not a judgment about what's right or wrong according to a particular thing that's in your field of vision. But it's the ability we have to open on this, what we call intuitive plane, where we're conscious, but we're not attached and locked into any particular object, but the consciousness is liberated, open and receptive to what is happening, both emotionally in our own mind, what, you know, your own particular emotional reactions to the present, thoughts, habitual thought patterns, values, judgments, identities. Includes the what you see, hear, smell, taste, touch, think and feel. It's about this open to this sensitive realm in a way that we're not just reacting, but we begin to see our reactions. We begin to have a perspective on our own feelings, not in terms of what's right and wrong, but in terms of they're like this, feelings change. The changingness of our emotions, how things change, you know, how one can feel positive one moment and negative the next. One can feel happy and elated and then suddenly depressed. It's just the emotional world is very ephemeral and dependent on other conditions. So to feel secure as a person, on a personal level, for me, Ajahn Sumedho, to feel personally secure and unthreatened and approved of and liked and make me feel happy and good on a personal level, and I need you to look at me and smile and you can tell me how wonderful I am. And how grateful you are for Amravati and all the rest, you know, and that you respect me and on like this, and then I can have this sense of everything's all right, I'm okay, you know, it feels secure, personally, personal emotions I'm talking about. Now those personal emotions, the reality of those emotions isn't in the quality of them, it's in the fact that they arise and cease according to conditions. So my feeling of everything's all right, everything's fine, I feel safe now, there's no kind of immediate threat, I can relax. That's an emotional state. And awareness of that is not attachment to it, but recognizing that that very state of feeling safe is dependent on other conditions. For me to personally feel safe depends on approval and other positive conditions that support that sense of everything's okay for me at this moment. But then if suddenly it changes, and somebody says, I think you're a phony, you know, you just make me sick every time I hear you. And you go, you call yourself a Buddhist and sometimes I've seen you look pretty mean and you try to appear like a nice person, but I'm sure, you know, I've seen signs of that you're really a monster underneath that placid smile. And then, oh, I feel insecure now, isn't it? Because on a personal level, you don't know who you are. I don't know who I am personally. Because it isn't, you know, it's so dependent on things. Whether I'm the confident, nice guy, or the angry, indignant, raging monster, well, these are manifestations according to conditions. And so, you know, this is, and so this we can actually begin to recognize the reality of this, that emotionally, you know, we have the emotional world that we live in. And so, you know, like, I think my emotional take on life is the really sensible one. You know, so living in a monastic community where you have both men and women, monks and nuns, living in the same community. It's quite interesting. Because what seems sensible and real to monks doesn't always seem that way to nuns. So, why? Why can't a woman be like a man? I think there was a song, My Fair Lady, wasn't there? And so you think, why can't they just be sensible and not make a scene over that? It's silly. And then the nuns say, oh, monks are always going. So this is, you know, how men, or, you know, both in a gender sense of how male conditioning, how it tends to interpret experience can be quite different from female. And yet we've got the idea we're all the same, and we're seeing that we're experiencing the same event. And on a rational level, you know, men tend to like the rational world a lot, you know, common sense, you know, the intellect and reason and logic, and it's so nice, and the emotional world is very threatening. I think most of us monks find the emotions of the nuns very threatening. Now, is that something wrong with us, or is that just the way it is, you know? One can make a scene that we shouldn't be threatened by it, but that's another ideal, is the fact that when the emotional world arises, we, you know, if we've not really tuned into that emotional thing, then we tend to suppress it or ignore it. And so we don't like it when other people get emotional around us, because then we don't know what to do. You know, don't know how to cope with that we don't know how to cope with it in ourselves or in someone else. Now, with awareness, you're opening up this consciousness to include. So it's not demanding that one be sensitive to emotions as some kind of thing that monks should try to become more sensitive towards their emotions, even though that's a good idea, but it's not an imperative. But it's being aware, because sometimes the nuns are so sensitive that it's hard to function. So if you get too caught up in emotions, you can't operate anymore. And if you don't understand the emotional world, then you just try to operate from ideals and orders and you do this, you do that, kind of organized, and we become terrible control freaks. So it's been very interesting this past week, because last week, Alan Cole, who has been a member of the layman of this community, who many of you probably know or knew, committed suicide here. So this was a terrible shock. You know, the suicide is one of the most shocking experiences I think you can have in your life, especially when it's somebody in your own family or community. And it wasn't expected, you know, it wasn't like there were, obvious signs or that, but because men are very good at hiding their feelings, you know, of looking, saying, I'm all right, yes, and then go and kill themselves. So this is dealing with this perception, you know, of loss, because Alan Cole was greatly appreciated. He was loved by us. He was a very good person. And, he seemed like a very strong person and very capable. And he was always helpful. You know, he was never a disruptive member here or difficult, as far as I'm aware of. And then several years ago, he did have a breakdown, and had to go on kind of medicines. And so he was visiting a consultant psychiatrist regularly. And, so that we were aware of, that he was having emotional problems. But he'd never tried this before, and he told people that he would never do that. So then we found out that he refused to take like antidepressant drugs. Now I don't know enough about this, you know, on the medical scene to have any opinions. But from what I can tell, these antidepressant drugs do help a lot. In terms of, when you're really in the pits of despair, you know, then they do help to lift you out of it, get you, you know, so you feel better. Now, what does that do, this information that I've just related, like Alan Cole committing suicide, you know, that right now that is a perception in the mind, isn't it? And it has its effect, and one can be aware of it. This is an exercise right now. What's real, the reality of this, is this, the feeling that I have when I think of Alan Cole now is like this. So before the, you know, when I came in for the meal this morning, the funeral for Alan Cole will be on the 10th of September, and his body will be brought back here on the Tuesday afternoon. And we'll keep it here in the Bodhinyana Hall until the 10th, and then it'll be cremated. But anyway, I made this announcement. And just having to talk about this gives me a certain feeling. And it isn't a subject I even want to talk about. In fact, my inclination on a personal level is to avoid even talking about it to anyone, because it is it brings up sadness. So even in a monk who's spent, you know, over 40 years meditating, you know, the loss of a friend in such a violent way, I mean, if it had just been killed by by a car or something, But I think suicide is much more shocking because it was unnecessary. But sometimes, you know, you kind of, you just seem to, if you're out on the M25, it's a risk we take in life. But we have no intention of doing it for suicidal reasons most of the time. But this also is in a monastery where the conditions are very good, you know, because he was in a situation where we were trying to be sensitive to his needs, so we didn't put him under pressure, you know, or have a lot of expectation or demands made on him. We were trying to look after him, and this was, and you know, we're quite glad to do this because he, you know, he was a friend of all of us. So then this happens, and this is what I feel. So this is just to share this with you, of being aware. The reality of that is, it's like this. When the perception of Alan Cole comes into my mind, the first one is loss or grief, sadness at loss. Now that is awareness of the real. It's not saying anything about how I should feel or anyone should feel. It's recognizing the reality of the feeling. It is changing. It's not, I can't sustain it. You know, I can't hold on to it and make myself feel this way on a permanent basis. But it's certainly like this. And so this is why this emphasis on awareness that the Buddha made, on mindfulness, wisdom, discernment, so that we start from the real, from the way things are, rather than from the ideal, the way things should be. The ideal monastery, Buddhist monastery, that should never happen. You know, nobody should, you know, that just shouldn't happen in according to my ideal monastery. And an ideal monastery where monks and nuns do understand each other very well and work together in harmony and share their lives and feel compassion and all these fine, lovely ideals. But the reality of living, you know, in a community of monastics, both male and female, is like this. It's not an ideal, but it is like this. And so, and then on a personal level, we affect each other in various ways. You know, just, you know, how, you know, what we think, what we say, what we expect, our body language, all kinds of things affect our consciousness in the present moment. And so the only way so we're not trying to create an ideal monastery according to some plan and beautiful image of the perfect Buddhist monastery, but using a situation for encouraging awakened awareness, this consciousness that includes everything, where we have perspective. In terms of relationship, then it's a moral one. Refraining from doing things harmful, divisive, deceitful, exploiting, with intention. You know, so sometimes we have no intention. Somebody feels exploited, but that's not our intention. And so, so we're not here to say, how can we exploit the Anagarikas now? We only have one Anagarika right now, Parish. I think he's on retreat. I think he must feel exploited sometimes. I don't know. but it's being at the kind of at the end of the hierarchical structure, and when you know, then that's where the reflection is. You know, I'm at the top, so I haven't been at the bottom of the hierarchy for years. But But whatever, that's not the point, is it? It's to be aware of that, and not to see, you know, to be aware of feelings of I'm at the bottom, so I'm not as good as Ajahn Sumedho is at the top. That kind of thing is another self-view, isn't it? Or we can, you know, be quite insensitive to each other in a community. So we try not to be, but sometimes that is just, you know, we have different personalities. Some people are very bossy and authoritative and control freaks, and others very passive and obedient. And it's a different personality. So we're trying to be aware of this rather than, you know, just punish and reward according to value systems or personal preferences. So how things appear, you know, like Alan Cole's appearance. Now it's interesting that the nuns or some of the women, lay women, like in the retreat center, that seemed to say, like they said, it's shocking, but it didn't surprise me. I said, why didn't it surprise you? And she said, well, he hasn't been connecting very well with anybody. No, I didn't really see that. So I was both shocked and surprised. So then after that, the next few days with everybody is living with, you know, kind of digesting this. Because, you know, this is a shock to not just me, but to whole community, everyone that comes here that knew him. Or even people that don't know him, just the information, even if you don't even know who I'm talking about. It's, you know, still shocking. Then the week before, we had another shock with a monk at Milton Keynes, the Reverend Honda, the head of the Peace Pagoda here in England. You know, he was, Reverend Honda was about 50 years old, mowing the lawn, cutting the grass at Milton Keynes, and somehow had an accident where he was knocked out, killed by his own lawnmower. Now, Reverend Honda was one of the most capable men I've ever met. You know, he looked strong, like those Japanese samurais, and he... You know, they're really tough, the Japanese Sangha. They built the Peace Pagoda in Battersea Park, and I used to watch them in the wintertime up there in T-shirts, you know, in the cold, in ice, you know, putting on roofing tiles and things like this. I just couldn't believe it. You couldn't get any of us to do that. And then they burn, if you look at their arms, you know, they light incense, you know, big bunch of incense, light it, and then they tie it to their arms and let it burn. And so they have terribly scarred upper forearms. And so we don't have to do that in Theravada. We're a bunch of sissies. Now these are just my impressions of Reverend Honda. Generally, he was a very admirable monk, and he was trying to clean up the Milton Keynes grounds because he was going to Japan to visit his old mother the following day, and then suddenly we get the news that he's dead. Now that was a shock and a surprise to everybody, because that wasn't, you know, one didn't expect that to happen. Someone so capable as Reverend Honda, at such a, you know, 50 years old, the height of his powers, and very capable person, suddenly gets killed by his lawnmower. Nobody can figure out quite how it happened. So that was another shock. But yet I didn't know him that well. You know, my occasions were seeing him in passing, really, visiting Milton Keynes or him. He was always, he'd come here and he'd, with Ajahn Yanarato, both being Japanese, a few days before he died, he came and he brought all kinds of nice Japanese things to Ajahn Yanarato. So, you know, he, Ajahn Yanarato used to like to go there on their Nagasaki days and Hiroshima days, connect with that. And so, you know, we had a good, amicable relationship with them as Buddhists also. They were very, very good people. So when we had the opening of the temple, they all came to our ceremony. So when something happens like that, like death, a sudden death is a shock. And this you can notice like a shock. Now this is how it affects me. I notice when I'm shocked, I don't feel anything for a while. So when I was told, first informed of Alan Cole's death by suicide, he hung himself in his room, I was shocked. So I didn't feel anything. I immediately went over to the Vihara, and then we were informing the police and doing all the things necessary. And I wasn't feeling anything at all. And, you know, somehow in that state of shock, your emotions seems to be suppressed. It wasn't intentional, but also you can still function. Your rational mind operates very well. So we were all being very efficient and practical about everything. And so this is, and then it took several, you know, a day following for it to really sink in into an emotional sense of grief, which came up quite spontaneously. So the conditions for that, you know, this is how this Buddhist reflection on conditioned phenomena, how one conditions arise, and then this is what you experience. So just using that sense of shock when you get information that's so shocking, your emotional world just packs up, and you just feel numb really, but you rationally you're all right. And then after a while, that will fall away, and then you feel the sense of loss and grief, part of the karma of loss, the losing. And so this is why I encourage this practice of awareness, mindfulness, reflection on the way it is, because this does give us a sense of being able to flow with our lives in whatever way they move, and a way we respond to particular contingencies, both praise and blame, or pleasant or unpleasant, or when we have, you know, about health problems, when we find out you have cancer, or you've got some terminal illness, or somebody close to you does, or whatever. These are all shocking, unwanted things or fears that we have. But yet, with mindfulness, with awareness, we can actually benefit from all these experiences because we're applying wisdom to experience rather than just being caught in fear and anger, resentment, just lost in disappointment and grief that we wouldn't maybe not understand our lives or ourselves because we've never reflected on the way it is, and our reality our sense of our security may depend on being healthy. Maybe, you know, I need to feel healthy and vigorous to feel okay about myself. This is very common with men. You know, you feel, you know, I'm still strong and I can still take care of myself, and then you start getting old and forgetful. And there's a certain reaction to that. You know, your sense of your self-worth is being, you know, it's just diminished. Where in terms of satipanya or mindfulness wisdom, it doesn't matter. I mean, you are aware of the way it is rather than just trying to support illusions, or feel, you know, that your life is worthless because you aren't the same, you can't do what you used to be able to do and be strong and confident like you used to be. So it's easy to get depressed when you get my age. And men go, you know, Alan's age, he was about 60. Easy to get depressed because, you know, that's an age where you are on the, you know, oftentimes in the societal terms, you know. What are we going to do with all these old people here in England? Who's going to take care of them? You hear this on Radio 4. And you think, yeah, who wants to look after an old kind of slobbering man? You know, you dread going to some nursing home. But in terms of reflection, it doesn't really matter. You know, so I tell the monks, I said, you know, just, you know, if I get too much problem, just put me in some cheap nursing home, it's okay. I hope they don't. But if that should happen, you know, I would know what to do with it. I would be able to reflect on that. You know, this is confidence you get from this kind of practice.